This is a recording of the special hearing on electioneering communication held by the Federal Election Commission on October 17th and 18th, 2007. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Good morning. I'd like to open the hearing of the Federal Election Commission for Thursday, October 18th, 2007. This is a continuation of our hearings on the question of whether the agency should amend its regulations in light of the Supreme Court's decision in Wisconsin Right to Life. We had a series of panels yesterday, and we will continue that today. We have a total of, I believe it is, 7 witnesses today who will occupy 2 different panels. The first panel will last about an hour and a half. We will then break for lunch and reconvene for the second panel this afternoon. Each of the witnesses will have 5 minutes for an opening statement. We have a light display system on the table in front of you to aid you in the management of that time. The green light will appear and will remain on for most of your time. It will start flashing when there is 1 minute left. The yellow light will come on when there's 30 seconds left, and the red light comes on when your time has expired. After that, we will open it up to questions from the commission. The commissioners simply can seek recognition from me. We will not go in any particular order, and commissioners can have follow-up questions as they would wish. In addition, the general counsel and the staff director's representative will also have an opportunity to ask questions if they would like. We had provided an opportunity for opening statements yesterday and had one. I assume none of the commissioners want to make opening statements again today in light of yesterday's testimony. Hearing none, then we will go to our first panel. Welcome, gentlemen. Our first panel this morning consists of Brian Schwoboda, who has ably come to instead of Bob Bauer, and he is appearing on behalf of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Mr. Schwoboda, I don't know whether you know it or not, the commission met earlier and by a vote of 5-0 have decided that you should read Mr. Bauer's blog this morning, a bit of prose in the tradition of Mr. Keats. And so if you could do that for us at the beginning, that would be excellent. Just kidding about that. We have Jeremiah Morgan here on behalf of the Free Speech Coalition. Welcome. And Michael Trister, who's here on behalf of the Alliance for Justice. We generally follow the alphabetical order in the order of our speakers. And so unless you have arranged among yourselves differently, that would involve Mr. Morgan going first, Mr. Schwoboda going second, and Mr. Trister going third. Hearing no mention of an alternative plan, Mr. Morgan, please proceed at your leisure.
Good morning, Chairman Leonard and members of the commission. My name is Jeremiah Morgan. I'm an attorney with the law firm William J. Olson, PC, and I'm appearing today on behalf of both the Free Speech Coalition and the Free Speech Defense and Education Fund. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on the proposed regulations. The Free Speech Coalition was founded in 1993 as a group of ideologically diverse nonprofit organizations, primarily Internal Revenue Code Section 501c4 organizations and the companies that work for them. Its purpose is to help protect such organizations' First Amendment rights through the reduction or elimination of excessive regulatory burdens on those rights. The Free Speech Defense and Education Fund was established in 1996 and is a Section 501c3 education and litigation sister organization of FSC. We filed written comments on behalf of both organizations on October 1st. Whenever an administrative agency loses a case in court and is required to rewrite its regulations, it faces the temptation to minimize its loss through the rulemaking process. We urge the Commission to resist this temptation. In this rulemaking proceeding, the Commission should pick up where Chief Justice Roberts left off in WRTL 2. In the final paragraph of the Chief Justice's opinion, he said, "When it comes to defining what speech qualifies as the functional equivalent of express advocacy subject to the electioneering communications ban, the issue we do have to decide, we give the benefit of the doubt to speech, not censorship." The regulations proposed by the Commission do not appear to follow suit. They do not give the benefit of the doubt to the rights guaranteed by the First Amendment. The Commission's jurisdiction is limited to the regulation of federal elections, and yet the Commission is being asked by some in Congress and some who testify here today to protect incumbents from criticism or pressure from their constituents. That should no longer be possible, as the Supreme Court in WRTL2 blew a hole in Congress's attempt to give each congressman and senator a pre-election trademark on the use of their names. Alternative 1's exemption would unconstitutionally maintain the reporting requirement for issue advertisements such as WRTLs. While the NPRM maintains that the commission could construe WRTL2 as not affecting the reporting requirements for electioneering communications, such a reading is not only illogical but unconstitutional. The commission cannot demand reporting without a nexus to federal elections. If it cannot regulate certain electioneering communications, it obviously cannot require reports on those expenditures. The same is true for disclaimer requirements. Likewise, Alternative 2 is unconstitutionally structured to exempt issue ads from its definition of electioneering communications. This is backwards. The WRTL court's opinion did not allow WRTL's ads as an exemption to BCRA Section 203. Instead, the court defined an ad that is the functional equivalent of express advocacy only if the ad is susceptible of no reasonable interpretation other than as an appeal to vote for or against a specific candidate. The NPRM converts this into an exemption if the communication is susceptible of a reasonable interpretation other than as an appeal to vote for or against a specific candidate. The converse of a statement is not the same as a statement, and when in doubt, stick with the court's configuration. Actually, neither alternative proposed in this NPRM would adequately incorporate the principles of the Supreme Court's decision in WRTL2. The two proposals appear to be based on the presumption that the constitutional difficulties can be remedied by creating an exemption in the faulty regulations. This is the effect of shifting the burden of proof to those engaging in political speech that they are covered by the exemptions or within the safe harbors. The Supreme Court in WRTL2 affirmed that ads such as WRTLs are political speech, thus the application of BCRA Section 203 is subject to strict scrutiny, and therefore the Commission has the burden to prove that a particular ad is a prohibited electioneering communication. Commission regulations should not be written so that an organization has to prove that it is exempt. Lastly, with respect to the NPRM's interest in the basic background information clause of the Supreme Court's decision, the NPRM treats that decision with selective creativity, which appears to show a lack of respect for the actual text of the opinion. The Chief Justice said, courts need not ignore basic background information that may be necessary to put an ad in context. The Commission could avoid entirely any consideration of basic background information if it heeded the court's other admonitions. The court said, for example, that the proper standard must entail minimal, if any, discovery. There generally should be no discovery or inquiry into the sort of contextual factors highlighted by the FEC. And finally, the need to consider such background should not become an excuse for discovery, or a broader inquiry of the sort we have just noted raises First Amendment concerns. And yet none of these relevant portions of the Chief Justice's opinion were even discussed by the NPRM. Sadly, in discussing basic background information, the NPRM manipulates the court's language to maximize its own role and to minimize the sphere of political speech. Hopefully, the Commission will reject both alternatives and adopt one which honors the language of the First Amendment as Chief Justice Roberts did at the close of his WRTL2 opinion. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Schwabitta.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob Bauer sends his apologies to the Commission. I'm told that he's not writing more poems as we speak, but was called away on urgent client business. And like as I might to read his poem, I have, unlike him, no poetic skills. So instead, I'm here on behalf of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. And we have, I think, a slightly different perspective than Mr. Morgan at least does on the matter and the task before the commission. Mr. Morgan asked the commission to, quote, pick up where Chief Justice Roberts left off and proceed to lend further effect to the Supreme Court's decision. But the commission has a different job than Chief Justice Roberts did. Its job was and remains to interpret and enforce the statute that Congress wrote and to lend the statute the maximum possible effect. It has to construe the statute, obviously, to avoid constitutional difficulties, but it's left at the end of the day with the principal task of fidelity to what it was that Congress passed. And there's real peril, I think, for the commission the more it attempts to do on this front in this rulemaking, especially in this small amount of time in which you have to act before the presidential elections. As we mentioned in our comments, the commission is always, as an administrative agency, on the weakest possible ground in court litigation when the positions it's advancing are not the result of an interpretation of the statute or an interpretation of the terms in the statute, but rather the commission's predictions about what a court might do, what a court could do, what a court should do. Any one of the eight of us here talking this morning might have an opinion about what WRTL2 means and what Chief Justice Roberts meant and what a court might say in the future, and each one of the eight of us would enjoy the same level of deference from a district court if the Pitt Commission gets sued, as I expect it probably will by somebody in some fashion, which is none. So the Commission has to be very cautious and very sparing, I think, in how it approaches this task, at least at this moment. And that's why we urge the Commission to adopt a minimalist, if you will, version of Alternative 1 before the Commission. Obviously, it needs to conform its regulations to what it was that the Supreme Court did this past June, but it needs to do so very carefully because there are developments as yet that none of us are going to be able to completely foresee. And we are especially mindful of this with regard to the disclosure requirements, an issue that was not before the court in WRTL2, and an issue where, if you read McConnell and you read the court opinions, that it's not clear that the same method of legal review and the same standard applies. So, for example, in the McConnell case, the Supreme Court made it clear that there was a difference between banning speech on the one hand and requiring disclosure of activities related to that speech in the other. And certainly, when faced with a statute that on its face unambiguously requires that disclosure, the Commission is simply not able to say that doesn't matter. We don't think that can constitutionally be upheld. It might try that, but that position is going to be vulnerable upon review. So the Commission needs to be very careful about drawing inferences from the WRTL case and making predictions about what the courts might do. And particularly in this short time frame, I hate to say it given who I represent, but a conservative course of action, I think, is going to serve the Commission best here. And that brings me to the second point that we raised in our comments, which is the definition of express advocacy and whether the Commission ought to open up 100.22 and give it a second look under the circumstances of WRTL. And our position, for much the same reasons, is that the Commission should not. The Commission wasn't considering in WRTL2 what is or isn't express advocacy, whether 100.22 is constitutional or wasn't constitutional. It claimed to be reviewing the regulation of something else entirely, the functional equivalent of express advocacy. A car is a car, but the functional equivalent of a car isn't a car. It might be some completely different sort of vehicle. It goes faster, goes slower, has different attributes. And the Commission needs to be mindful of that. Clearly, Congress didn't think that they were regulating express advocacy when they wrote Title II of BCRA, and clearly they thought that they were regulating something else. And it's important to note, and here I'll conclude my comments, that to revise 100.22 at this point has the effect to create havoc well beyond the corporate and union interests that are here today seeking review of the WRTL case. So, for example, party committees and PACs issue communications every day in reliance on the Commission's current definition of express advocacy. I mean, for example, we're going to have a different president of the United States in January 2009, whoever that may be. Knock wood, it'll be a Democrat. And my client is apt to be issuing communications that will be referring to that person. You know, probably referring to them quite positively, probably flunking the PASO standard. And is that express advocacy of that individual? I mean, in most of the contexts in which we do that, plainly not. But that's an example of how the Commission, if it acts too quickly, too precipitously on this front, could cause issues for others in the regulated community that it need not and should not cause. And thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Trister?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to start by weighing in on this issue of Alternative 1 versus Alternative 2, and particularly how it bears on the reporting requirements. I tend to agree with those like Mr. Swoboda who have argued that the Roberts opinion does not resolve the issue. If it did, if it was unequivocal, even though the issue wasn't raised, if the reasoning and language of the opinion was so absolutely clear on the question, then I think you'd have to follow it. But I don't think you can fairly argue that position. I think that the not only was the issue not raised, it was not discussed. And as a number of the comments point out, there's a serious question about what the standard of review is for constitutional purposes, whether it's even the same standard as was being applied in that case, and so on. I simply think it's not fair, really, to construe the case as having resolved the question and left the commission really with no choice. But that, I think, only puts the question before you. What do you then do? What is your choice? And I think that this is where I depart company from Mr. Swoboda. I think, frankly, that the conservative approach that he says he's arguing for is, in fact, alternative two. And let me say why. Basically, the court has left you in a position where they have created a new category of speech, which was not before Congress when it wrote its reporting requirements. And that's the fact. We don't know, and it's really impossible to know for us, how Congress would have decided this question. Yet it does raise important constitutional questions. And it strikes me that the real question then is, what does this agency do without any guidance by the court, by Congress, on these difficult questions? One of the key questions will be, has Congress decided that it wants reporting in this area, this very narrow category of speech, which really didn't exist? And secondly, what kind of reporting does it want? And it strikes me that those are questions that ought to be answered by Congress in the first instance, not by the court. And given that position, it strikes me that the correct institutional position for the commission is to adopt alternative two and basically say to Congress, if you want reporting in this area, legislate. Tell us what you want. Answer the difficult questions. Do you want reporting of this particular type of speech, this narrow category of speech, which is constitutionally protected, at least in some of its ramifications? Do you want reporting so that if there are going to be challenges, as Mr. Swoboda says, then we will at least know that Congress has made the decision that there are interests at stake that require reporting in this area, and it has also left room, it has also addressed the question of how that reporting should take place. The reporting requirements that exist, that were written as part of BCRA, were written in the context essentially of individuals being able to, and unincorporated entities being able to do electioneering communications. They were not written for corporations, nonprofit corporations, for-profit corporations, and unions, who are the ones who are now had this category of speech opened up to it. And so it strikes me that the conservative approach here, institutionally, is for the commission to essentially send this back to Congress. I realize there are time limits involved, but from the standpoint of Congress, at least, this is a fairly new issue. The court acted in June. We're sitting here in October, and they've got plenty of time to address this question when and if they want to. And I think that the appropriate approach in that context is alternative two, which leaves it to Congress to resolve. A second point that I'd like to move on to now came from my reading of the comments that were filed. And it has to do with this question of what is a safe harbor. I read the proposal in the NPRM as presenting first a general rule which tracks Roberts' opinion and then creates two safe harbors. And I assumed, and our comments proceeded from the assumption, that the way that would work is that if you fell within the safe harbor, one of the two safe harbors, then you were per se protected. If you did not, then you the inquiry switches back to the general rule. And I had thought that was fairly clear, and I think some of the comments certainly follow that approach. What worries me is that there are some comments that were submitted which suggest that the safe harbor is sort of the end-all of the discussion, that they are, in effect, that the safe harbor, if you don't fit within the safe harbor for grassroots lobbying, then that's it, that there is no further inquiry. And it seems to me, I don't recall the specific sets, but there were several sets of comments which seemed to me to make that assumption, and that worries me. And so I would urge that if you are going to have safe harbors, that you make it clear that the safe harbor is just that, a safe harbor. I do a lot of tax work. We have lots of safe harbors in terms of tax work. And it's an opportunity. If you fit within it, that's the end of the discussion. But if you don't fit within it, there's still the general rule to be applied. I think that's especially important because of the issue of burden of proof. We think that the court made it absolutely clear that the burden of proof in this instance and on these questions is on the commission. If the commission wants to prohibit or penalize a group for having made a communication which violates Section 203, the burden is on the commission to show that it can do it constitutionally.
If I could just jump in, I think the little red light is sadly indicating that the 5 minutes have come.
Okay, well, I'm sure we'll have a chance to continue this as we get into the question.
And on your last point, we had some discussion of this yesterday, and I think that your sense of what the safe harbors were to achieve is the sense of the commission as to what the safe harbors were to achieve. But we were obviously, noted that a number of commenters had some confusion, and certainly we'll try and clarify that in whatever the final rule is. We now open the hearing to questions or comments from the commission. Vice Chairman Mason.
Mr. Morgan, I appreciate your comments. I appreciate where you're coming from. I appreciate the fact that you made them. I'm always asking people in general to comment before the commission and people who reflect the views you represent to comment. But I have a problem. Today is October 18th. One of the parties has just set the date for the Iowa caucuses of January the 5th, which means that the statutory time frames relevant to this issue that we're dealing with go into effect on December the 6th, that is 46 days from now. We have to do something, and we don't have the choice of saying that we're not going to do it or we don't understand. And so you have presented some cogent criticisms of the approaches, but we don't have the choice of going back to the drawing board. And so we can, what we thought we were trying to do was fill in some of the spaces and give people something that they could work with. Otherwise, your clients are going to be out there wanting to run ads, and you're going to be looking at the Supreme Court decision and making your own interpretation. And as Mr. Swoboda pointed out, how much deference is that going to get? And what kind of risk? And how does the commission, who, believe you me, we didn't pass the law, we didn't file the lawsuit, we didn't write the opinion, so we didn't really ask for a lot of this. And clearly, from the commission's enforcement perspective, whether we like the policy or not, it's a whole lot easier to enforce the blanket rule. Mention a federal candidate on a broadcast, boom, you're out of there. Okay, so I'm just left a little bit disappointed that you would not give us something to work with from the perspective of somebody who's out there representing people and presumably would want some further guidance. And I can't, if you haven't put anything out already, I don't know what there is, but I just want to note that and urge you next time to think about the predicament the commission's in, because we don't have the choice of postponing the enforcement of the statute, and to try to give us something to work with. And if you have a way, for instance, of and I'll let you respond if you want to, putting into regulatory language the test of giving the benefit of the doubt to speech, what would it look like?
Well, fortunately, I don't have to write the regulations. I don't envy your position at all, and your job and your task. But as these proposed regulations are drafted, the ones that are here, I think we're still going to be looking at the language, you know, the language and the decision in WRTL 2.
If I could follow up on that, the I don't know whether you read it, and I was just flipping through the pages to recall, but my recollection is the AFL-CIO presented an alternative test. Mm-hmm. As to rather than amending either 129 or 114, they had a simpler and in some ways more elegant test, and I wanted to see if you either recalled that or you can actually submit comments later as whether that would resolve some of the concerns you were raising as to whether we had cleaved close enough to the constitutional lines there.
Yeah, I didn't analyze that closely.
Mr. Trister seems to recall it, though.
No, not on that specifically,
okay.
But more relevant to this. I think one of the points that we make in our comments is that we feel that the language which you've proposed for the general rule is not consistent with the Roberts opinion because it seems to shift the burden of proof away from the commission to the speaker. And we have proposed language. It's in our comments. It's not a major change. It's simply a change in a few words, actually. And I think that is something you can decide one way or the other if you agree with us or not. But I do think on that narrow point.
No, I appreciate that. No, I wanted to follow up on that as well. I understand the burden of proof issue, and obviously the language can suggest that. I don't think there was any attempt by the staff who drafted this or the commissioners who were reviewing it to shift the burden of proof, and I think that might better be stated if it needs to be stated somewhere else. In other words, the test is one thing, and who bears the burden of making the showing is really a separate issue, and you could write the test the same way and yet place the burden on one side or the other. So I'm a little puzzled by the addition or the deletion of the negative. You know, no other reasonable interpretation. I think it's maybe being overread. I'd like to suggest that. But what I want to ask is what that means. If, for instance, we say, well, the commission bears the burden, and so if we get a complaint, we would ask the commission staff to go out and look at a particular communication and analyze it to see whether there's any other reasonable interpretation or whether no other reasonable, either way. But what does that mean? I mean, does it mean that the staff attorney looking at it, you know, looks at it, says, gee, looks like express advocacy to me? I can't think of anything else. In other words, how do we prove a negative in that sense, and in the real world of how these things are going out, how are we going to avoid? I mean, we could sort of try to guess and surmise, but our list might not be complete. And in that sense, that's why you can't prove a negative. So what is it you really mean when you're talking about the burden is on us to show there's no other reasonable interpretation?
Well, I think it means a couple of things. One is, you know, in the case law, there's a distinction between the burden of proof or the burden of persuasion and the burden of production, both of which are sometimes called the burden of proof. And I think we're clearly talking about the burden of persuasion here. That is to say, if there's a close call, if it is not entirely clear, but there are reasons articulated, and it is possible to read it one way and not or two ways or three ways, that the court is essentially saying, then you protect speech, that the burden of proof is on you, that the burden of persuasion, as it were, is on the commission. And I think that means, at least in close cases, that the balance, as Justice Roberts said in lots of colorful ways, tips towards the speaker. And I think it at least means that.
Yeah, but doesn't that mean in the real world, you know, when we go to court, in essence, we're going to, you know, go in and say, if we think we've got speech that violates this, there isn't any other reasonable interpretation. And we may discuss some things about the speech that leads us to that conclusion, that it mentions candidates, that it, you know, mentions voting, that, you know, whatever factors are in there. But in the real world, then, isn't the response, aren't you going to write on behalf of your client or whoever's representing them, well, in fact, there was a bill up at, you know, at that time. And so, you know, while I understand the legal matter of the burden of persuasion, I'm just wondering how we actually write that in the test, in the operative test, as opposed to stating who has the burden, and because that's where you suggested that we rewrite the operative test for the purpose of allocating the burden, and I'm not sure those two are precise fits.
Right. I think that the initial stage for the commission will be a complaint is pending. And the speaker will be asked to respond to that. And I think that the burden of proof, again, comes into play at that point. I think that there may be situations in which the commission is going to simply say, we're not even going to request a response. Or we're going to set up a procedure. We actually suggested that there might be some expedited procedure, in which, given the fact that the burden is on the commission to prove these, in which you may basically be able to let people off the hook very, very quickly because of the burden at that stage, so we don't have to do anything. Secondly, I think it's going to affect the discovery and the information which comes out of the enforcement people in terms of what they're demanding and what they're asking for. And that's one reason we asked, in addition to that slight change to reflect the burden, we asked that and again, we suggested specific language, we asked that you include some of the warnings, if you will, that Justice Roberts put into his opinion about how it's not, the test does not require effect or intent, for example, and we'd like to see that as a message to enforcement, to basically be saying to the enforcement staff, don't be asking about intent. Don't be asking about these various kinds of things. Don't be asking about context. And we'd like to see language along that line as well. So I think that it comes into play at that stage in terms of how you have to respond, what you have to respond to, and indeed whether you respond to a complaint. We may very well, and at that point, if a group decides not to respond, that doesn't mean they lose the case. That doesn't mean that you go forward with an investigation. I think the burden means that. That's another way in which the burden kicks in. So as somebody who represents a lot of respondents in a lot of cases, I first look at it at that stage of the process. And I think that that's in many ways where these questions of burden really play out in important ways in terms of what can be asked. Are we going to get in? If you do open an investigation, are you going to ask us, you know, all these questions about context and all the kind of things which I think the court rejected and said were not relevant? We'd like to see a regulation which makes it clear that those issues are not relevant throughout the enforcement process. And I think that's also part of what we were striving for in our proposed language.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Well, my views on enforcement are probably the least relevant of anybody on this panel, since I won't be here by the time these enforcement cases come around. My personal view, just to respond on my part, is that most of these would fall out at the RTB stage, that we wouldn't get into discovery. We would be making a determination based on the complaint and the I guess there could be circumstances if we don't actually have the text that where we might have to get the text in order to make that determination. But, you know, the kind of context that I hear the court talking about is the sort of thing that you kind of know anyway. Oh, there's a comparative ad between these two candidates who I happen to know are running against each other, and, you know, why else would they be, you know, discussed in the same ad? You know, that, you know, I don't, without predicting whether that in and of itself would be an important factor, you know, it's the sort of thing, just the stuff you know off the top of your head. But I would assume that it would be, you know, for the most part, a determination based on what's in the complaint. Now, having said that, I'll just tell you that in my experience, I think it's usually helpful when people respond to complaints. And when they don't, I've seldom seen anybody hurt themselves by responding to a complaint, but I've frequently seen things that we ended up saying, well, we just don't know about this. So, you know, we end up moving to RTB and asking some questions. So my advice to you as a practitioner is to, yes, please respond.
I don't think I've ever not responded.
Remember that, yes. But let me ask you guys a question, because I think that I'm probably somewhere in between Brian and Michael in that I would like to do as little as possible. I am, you know, in what Allison Hayward called the humble regulator mode here, and I hear what you're saying about not upsetting the apple cart and not, you know, creating uncertainty, and I think that's important. But I also agree with some of what Michael was saying about how, you know, what did Congress mean? What, you know, did Congress intend for these groups to have to do disclosure? And the comment that was most persuasive to me on this point was the one that the labor unions filed, because it seems to me that you wouldn't even get very useful information out of making a labor union disclose the names of all of its members, anybody who paid membership dues in the last year, if they were to make an EC. And even Don Simon couldn't come up yesterday with any policy reason why you would want that kind of disclosure. So my question to you, and by the way, I gave take-home tests yesterday, so, you know, if you want to think about this and then submit comments later, that's fine too. Is there some way that we could preserve the disclosure piece of it? Because I think it's still on the books and we kind of have an obligation to do that, and yet define donation perhaps in some way to exclude union dues, which I'm pretty, my sense is, you know, is kind of an over-the-top disclosure, and yet not open the door to, you know, Republicans for Clean Air or other of those, you know, the sort of organizations that are always described as shady or shadowy, and you don't know who the donors are behind them. And that's the sort of disclosure that I think Congress actually has historically been concerned about. Is there some way to catch one and not the other?
Commissioner, I think there might be. I was thinking about the issue of Congress and what they may have thought of and going back to the legislative history. And there's one, actually, if you look back far enough, there was maybe one moment when the bill was on the floor of the Senate when it looked like this issue might come up, and it was when it was before the Wellstone Amendment was passed. And it was, there was a moment when it was contemplated that certain types of corporations or certain types of incorporated 527s might sponsor electioneering communications, and the way the Congress proposed out at that point was the segregated account, you know, provision. In other words, if you had, in other words, the option that was presented, which is the basic option that remains in the statute for electionary communication sponsors, is if you, we recognize that the disclosure of a large number of shareholders or a large number of members is going to be burdensome for some organizations. So can we present an option to limit that, you know, whereby the electionary communications are paid out of a segregated account and the funds from that account that trigger the thresholds under the statute, which actually are relatively high relative to independent expenditure definitions. I don't know where they relate in terms of what people pay in union dues on an annual basis. I'll leave that to Mike. But, you know, you could limit your disclosure by following that step. Now, is that something that Congress would have necessarily envisioned or intended for this particular situation? I don't think any of us could say that. But is it an indication of at least the direction in which Congress was thinking when it wanted to provide opportunities to limit disclosure? Perhaps so.
So is your answer basically, if the unions want to avoid disclosing their members, they can just make the EC out of their separate segregated fund?
That's one possible option based on how Congress thought about this, to the extent they were thinking about this when they wrote it.
Just to follow up on that, if I could, Mr. Trister had also suggested that 501c organizations that were not 501c5 organizations, like labor unions, that we rely on line one of the IRS Form 990s. Can you describe for us what gets put on line one?
Well, line one of the Form 990, which is the annual tax return which all 501Cs file, is essentially gifts, grants, and contributions. It is not business, it's not interest, it's not investment income, which is reported out separately. It's not what is called program service revenue, which is if you go out and you sell your services of one kind or another. That's reported on line two. And it's not rents, it's not all things of that kind. What we were getting into, and really I think an issue which is not so important for the unions, but more for the 501c4s and c3s that are involved, is the distinction between a general support grant, a grant that's given to an organization and they do what they want with it as long as they're within their tax exempt purposes, and what the tax people call an earmarked grant, or a special project grant, a grant that is designated for a specific purpose. And what we were attempting to raise in our comments was the notion that general support grants, even though they are reported on line one, that they should not be reported as a donation, that they should not be included within the definition of donation as for at least this purpose. And I think that's a question really which didn't exist until Wisconsin Right to Life essentially put this to these new kinds of entities. I don't think you had to worry about that terribly much. But now I think it's a critical question. And the reason we think that that's a reasonable distinction is, first of all, is that the reporting requirement is so broad. The reporting requirement requires that you report anybody who gave $1,000 at any time over the current fiscal year or the previous fiscal year. So to draw a connection between a person who gives $1,000 or $2,000 for broadcast ads, remember, we're talking about big expenditures here, over a period that wide, 22-month period, essentially, and suggest to the public that they had something to do with funding that ad, seems to me to be misleading the public. It seems to be unfair to the donors, and also, particularly if they didn't earmark it. If they gave it whenever they gave it, they said, here's $1,000, I want you to run an ad, and here's the $1,000, then I think they ought to report that. But if they give them $1,000 and say, here's $1,000, I like your organization, keep up the good work, which is essentially a general support grant, then I think it's unfair and misleading to the public to suggest that that person was connected to the ad in some way, that they paid for the ad. And so what we argue is that the distinction ought to be made between earmarked and non-earmarked. That is exactly what Congress did on reporting IEs, reporting for IEs. The language of the statute says you don't report all donations. You report donations that, I can't remember the exact words, we have it in our comments, but it basically says that we're given for the purpose of the ad. And it seemed to us that it's reasonable to follow the same approach in this context for a number of reasons. One is that when Congress, if you look at the legislative history, Congress essentially said we are extending the IE reporting to ECs. That's all they thought they were doing. They were taking the IE. They didn't write it that way. If they'd been more careful, we wouldn't have this issue. But they basically said we are trying to extend IE reporting to EC reporting. When the commission defended that reporting in McConnell, it said the same thing, and we quote parts of your brief, and the McConnell opinion treats it the same way. There's a footnote in the McConnell opinion where they say, what's the big deal about this EC reporting? It's just like what we already have for IEs. Well, so it seemed to me that it was reasonable to approach the reporting on EECs in the same way. And the key distinction is between a grant or a gift that's given just to an organization for any purpose and leaves it to the organization to decide how to spend is not something that needs to be reported, but something that does need to be reported is I think, is something which is earmarked, what the tax lawyers call earmarked, for that particular purpose, to support the grant, to support the ad. And that's a distinction which we tried to.
Mr. Schwobert, yeah.
I agree with the concern that Mr. Trister is laying out, and don't doubt that particularly with unions, there's a very difficult situation that the commission's going to have to resolve. But the commission has to be very, very careful about the manner in which it resolves it, particularly when it gets past those situations, because the identities of donors for organizations that sponsor electioneering communications are a subject of urgent political interest for the candidates who are affected by those ads. A candidate might have an organization running an ad in their district, goes up Friday night, you know, 15 days before the election, and no way of knowing who the donors are. And the donors, even if they haven't necessarily earmarked their funds for those communications, the identity of the donors may be very, very essential to the political response. And let's assume for the moment that there's nothing else legally that can be done about the ad. Let's assume that the commission can't go to court and get an injunction to stop them. Let's assume further that, you know, let's just assume that the ad is probably going to stay up. So the burden on the candidate is going to be to have some sort of political response, and the identity of the donors is going to be critical to that. So, for example, for John McCain in 2004, the fact that Republicans for Clean Air was sponsored by, or what the ads that the biggest donors to those organizations were somebody from his principal opponent's home state, neither of whom had a particular record of caring about clean air, was immensely important to how those ads were assessed, viewed, and ultimately discounted in the free media. So the commission, clearly the commission needs to do something to address the particular anomaly that this case has created, but it needs to be very careful about how to do that. I don't think you want a situation, for example, where a Sam Wiley might send his check to Republicans for Clean Air and say, this is a general grant for the organization to be spent at your sole discretion.
And I think that you put your finger on the exact problem that I've got, which is, you know, it's fine for, you know, most of the members of the Alliance for Justice, you know, which are ongoing organizations and have other things that they're doing besides running ECs. And it's, you know, and it's fine for labor unions for the same reason, because they do other things. But an organization like Republicans for Clean Air pops up, and its only purpose is to put out communications and otherwise try and get involved to the extent that they can in the election. So they don't have to earmark anything, because that's all the organization's doing in the first place.
And well, remember, if they are in fact a political committee, then they're going to have to report all of that. And so that may in fact pick up some of these groups set up just for the purpose of running ECs in a particular election. And given the way that the commission's been enforcing that in terms of how they raise the money and so on, this money doesn't just show up out of nowhere. And so I think that it's very possible that some of these groups that you're concerned about will in fact be political committees and should be registered as such and should be reporting as such, which means reporting all their donors. It doesn't make that distinction.
Although, but more realistically, the commission will decide 3 years later that they should have been a political committee while our candidates are going to crocheting
classes.
We're
getting better at
back
that
in the
point.
District.
Right. But the other problem, I think, is it's not a problem of your making. And if Congress had written a rule which said a reporting rule which was limited and narrow, then I think you'd have a different kind of question. The problem we have is, on the one hand, Mr. Swoboda is worried, or you're concerned about somebody who gives them $100,000 or $200,000 2 weeks before the election, but we've got a reporting requirement which picks up anybody who gives $1,000 or more over a 22-month period. Could be January of the calendar year before somebody writes a check for $1,000 to the group. And you didn't write that rule, but that's the rule, and that's the reporting we're going to have to do unless you make that distinction. So to some extent, I think you're between a rock and a hard place on this issue, and I don't sympathize with that. But I think that you've got to be aware, just as Mr. Swoboda wants you to be aware of this situation where somebody comes in and writes a big check and says, by the way, You know, to some extent, it is factual. And you do get into exactly these kinds of questions in lots of different areas that you enforce. Was there an earmarking? Was there something? Or was it purely, that's a factual inquiry. If you really think that somebody really, although they never said the word earmark, that it was in fact understood, you've got the investigatory authority to look into that situation. And the facts may well push you in that way in a particular reporting situation. So I think it's...
But wouldn't that require exactly the kind of discovery that you told us that we shouldn't engage in?
No. This is on a reporting question. This is on a question of what has to be reported. This is not on whether you can run an ad or not.
But that just pushes the problem one step back, right? Because if there's no reporting and somebody files a complaint saying these people should have reported donors, and then we begin in the down the discovery path. I guess my question was more to Mr. Swoboda. Do your concerns fall away if the test turns on whether the funds were the product of a solicitation to run these sorts of ads? Approach we've started taking in determining whether people have solicited contribution or funds for use in federal elections.
Taking the most extreme set of circumstances we might face, a group like Republicans for Clean Air running ads that they're arguing are WRTL qualified, I'm not sure it does. I mean, just because of the circumstances in which the funds would raise. It may be an organization set up by one guy who decides that he's going to fund it. I mean, there may be no solicitation. The solicitation may be in his head. And then the question is, what is the proper level of disclosure? And in that situation, our clients need some level of disclosure. Again, it's essential to their political response to the ad.
I want to hone in on that question, though. As I understand it from going back to Buckley, the purposes of disclosure, paraphrasing, informing the public about a candidate's supporters. This is not the candidate's supporters, it's their opponents. Preventing corruption or aiding in law enforcement. And what you said in your written comments were this was essential to strategic decision making, and you've said something related here today. First, a comment. We have to realize there is an element here of a potential threat to someone who's criticizing an office holder. I understand what you're saying from your client's perspective, but from the perspective of the clients, the people sitting on either side of you, the fact that an incumbent office holder wants to know who is behind this attack on me, that's a threatening question. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so that's why all of a sudden we're into this First Amendment protected area. But I want you to define a little better why the necessity to make a political response related to the identity of the speaker or the necessity to make strategic decisions is a valid purpose for requiring disclosure.
Well, I think it relates back, Commissioner, to the prong you cited about knowledge of who a candidate's supporters or opponents are. I mean, this is ground that the Supreme Court plowed in the McConnell case when they reviewed whether the disclosure requirements could be applied generally. And I think there was a presumption by the court, certainly as there was by the Congress, that people who were sponsoring ads within the 30 and 60-day windows were apt to be supporters of a candidate. And so... And they assessed, in turn, the concern that you raised, a very valid concern, which is, in what circumstances does the forced identification of a donor create circumstances for that donor that might be injurious to his or her own interests? And they went back, for example, to NAACP v. Alabama, which was the core authority that they were reviewing and assessing the question, and they concluded that it provided no bar to disclosure in that instance. I mean, that there was a difference, for example, between being somebody in 2007 making a donation to a political organization sponsoring advertisements, with the possibility that there might be people who disapprove or approve of that transaction, and being a member of the NAACP in Alabama, where people were afraid even to meet with Thurgood Marshall to discuss whether to participate in his lawsuits or not, where there were real threats of retribution or even in some instances violence. And so that's what led the court in McConnell to determine that the disclosure requirements were constitutional, and we haven't seen anything in WRTL 2 that disturbs that analysis. They didn't talk about it. They didn't speak disapprovingly about it. And as I said in my opening statement, the constitutional analysis for whether a corporation or union could be prohibited from making electioneering communications is a different analysis from whether some information about the identity of the financial supporters or principal financial supporters could be placed on the public record.
Can I follow up on that?
Yes, please, Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
You know, I keep hearing this, and Ryan, you just repeated it, well, they didn't deal with the disclosure requirement. But there's language in the case at page 2672 in which Justice Roberts says, but to justify regulation of WRTL's ads, this interest must be stretched yet another step to ads that are not the functional equivalent of express advocacy. Enough is enough. Issue ads like WRTL's are by no means equivalent to contributions. And the quid pro quo corruption interest cannot justify regulating them. Now, the judge is saying, the justice is saying that one of the reasons laid out for the substantial government interest in the Buckley case, which is the corruption interest, that doesn't justify regulating it. And he doesn't say anywhere in there that any of the other two reasons, which the vice chairman talked about, that they laid out in Buckley, justify regulating them. And yet everyone seems to be saying to us, well, you should ignore his language where he says that they can't justify regulating WRTL's ads. Yeah, you shouldn't regulate them in terms of prohibiting them, but yes, you should regulate them in terms of requiring them to make contributions. And, you know, I have a hard time understanding that dichotomy when you have the Chief Justice saying that they cannot justify regulating issue ads. And I want to ask you about that, but I also want to ask you, okay, you know, you're on behalf of your client saying that we should require disclosure, something that we would have to extend to them. They've been prohibited from making these kind of communications, so there's never been any disclosure. So we would, in adopting Alternative 1, not only have to now allow them to do genuine issue ads, but we also have to extend the disclosure requirements to them. And I don't quite understand how it is that we would have the authority to do that and not also, for example, require, if we have the authority to require disclosure of contributions that are used to do genuine issue ads that are broadcast on TV or satellites, well, does that also mean that we have the authority to require contributions that are used to produce genuine issue ads in newspapers? Or when Wisconsin Right to Life, or maybe the Alliance for Justice, if they are going to spend money to fly in their members and they're going to go in and lobby congressmen and senators on a particular issue, something that they've run a TV ad on, something they've run a newspaper ad on, do we have the authority in this statute code to require disclosure of those contributions? I don't understand how we can differentiate, because if we have the ability to require disclosure of broadcast ads that are genuine issue ads, we're not talking about political ads, then why don't we have the authority, and why should we not extend it to disclosure of all their other issue activities?
Well, first, Commissioner, you had me at enough is enough. I was with you there. But I guess the answer to that is you have to look at the architect of the statute that the Congress passed. I mean, the real question is, what can the Commission do now in response to WRTL 2? And you have a statute that's written to define electioneering communications without a WRTL exception as yet, that requires their disclosure, regardless of the character of the sponsor. I mean, if we wanted to get real, very theoretical about it, I mean, theoretically, a corporation that was illegally spending Treasury funds on electioneering communications nonetheless would be subject to the disclosure requirements of Section 201. It'd be an independent basis of liability in the complaint that you would initiate against them in federal district court. So that requirement is there. The question is, given that the requirement is there and the Congress has put it there, and given that the court, you know, has, and I think we can all stipulate you know, at least raised in all of our minds that there may be some doubt in some circumstances about its application, you know, what is the Commission's proper response to that situation? And where the Commission is faced, frankly, right now, is a choice between the statute, which it's bound by the statute and administrative law to interpret and enforce, and the footnote in Chief Justice Roberts' opinion, which the Commission might take or might not take to read a particular way. And I guess my answer to that is the Commission's got to go with the statute. If the Commission goes with Chief Justice Roberts' footnote, then, as we talked about earlier, the Commission's in a very weak situation in a litigation posture in court. Another court might say, well, that's not what Chief Justice Roberts meant. Chief Justice Roberts might say, that's not what I meant. And in any event, however, their opinion of that statute and how, or of that opinion and how it should be interpreted is going to be, you know, is going to be superior to yours or ours. So I guess my answer to the question, to really boil it down, is I think the statute actually does require that disclosure, and I think it's the Commission's obligation to seek it.
Where does it require disclosure of independent groups and individuals for non-electoral activities? Are you saying that you disagree that the Wisconsin Right to Life decision said that the Wisconsin Right to Life ads were non-electoral ads?
No, I don't disagree with
that.
Well,
then where in the statute does it say that independent groups and individuals have to report on electoral activity? Anybody who engages in independent activity, an individual, for example, who sets out and puts up an ad, you know, buys a billboard and puts up an ad, they only have to register with us and report that if the ad is an election message, an attempt to influence the election. If they put up an ad about an issue, they don't have to register with us. They don't have to report their activities. Where in here do we have the authority to require disclosure of non-electoral activities?
Section 201 of BCRA, until, I guess, July 29th of this year, or whenever WRTL 2 came out, they definitely had to disclose. I mean, we can argue about whether they should have or should not have as a matter of constitutional law or as a matter of prudential legislative judgment, but that's in fact what the statute in most instances said. And the question is, given what the court said in WRTL 2, are you still bound to enforce those disclosure requirements in the statute? And I think you probably are. Somebody may yet challenge them. I think that's actually one of the top 10 reasons why you're probably going to get sued in the next 12 months, because I think somebody is going to challenge it and say that they shouldn't be applied to us. And they may win and they may lose, but the question is what you do today in the absence of court guidance.
Somebody with the initials JB, maybe?
Can I follow up on that?
Please. All right, well then let's talk about Buckley again. They gave, and the three requirements that they gave for justifying disclosure requirements. I mean, one was the corruption argument. Well, I think Justice Roberts' statement that it's not corruption throws that out. Mm-hmm. The third reason they gave for justifying disclosure is to serve as an essential means of gathering the data necessary to detect violations of the funding limitations. There are no funding limitations. If a donor wants to give $1 million to the Alliance for Justice, and a corporation wants to give them $1 million to run ads to convince Congress not to pass a particular piece of legislation, that's not a violation of the law. The $2,300 limit doesn't apply. So obviously that provision doesn't apply. That only leaves the one that the Supreme Court said about providing the electorate with information as to where political money comes from and is spent by the candidate. But since the court has said this is not an electoral message, it's an issue ad, the third justification for disclosure, again, goes out the window. So how could what we do be constitutional if we adopted alternative one?
Well, I mean, I'll let Mike Trister speak to that after I have, but I guess my answer to that would be, you've laid out the brief for the petitioner that I would write if I were representing the Alliance for Justice and seeking an injunction against the application of Section 201. But it's a conclusion, while I think it's an argument that could be made, while I think it's an argument that you will face, it is not, I think, a sufficient basis for the Commission at this point, with the opinion having reviewed what it did and done what it did, to say that we're going to set aside and ignore an entire section of the regulations that was not under review in WRTL and in contravention of congressional intent. I mean, that's the problem. The problem is if the agency takes this position now and writes it into its rules now, it's vulnerable to a challenge that it's acting in contravention to the plain language of the statute, which requires it. And then the agency's got troubles if these rules are being challenged, unless somebody else seeks an injunction and gets an order enjoining the enforcement of Section 201.
Can I touch on another argument that you raised earlier? On the same theme that we should approach this, our task, humbly or conservatively or whatever the turn of phrase people want to use is. And you said that, and in both your papers and in your opening statements, that that there was an interest in stability of the rules as we go into the electoral cycle, and the word you used to describe it is that I think in your opening was there would be havoc for these changes to occur. And I think you were talking specifically at that point about either amending or repealing 100.22b. But I wanted to sort of see if you could elaborate a little bit on why what we might do could be so disruptive. And I think there have been a number of points that are saying, well, it would be fine for the groups and that are advocating for these changes, but other kinds of committees are going to end up really betwixt and between in decision making as they go into the election. I don't entirely understand why that's true. Mm-hmm. Certainly, as it goes to 122B, it would seem that their lives would be dramatically easier or simpler to sort through. And so I wanted to see if you could sort of elaborate for us why these changes would lead to such disruptions or chaotic results.
Well, we wrote it specifically with regard to 100.22B, and it's something the party committees and political committees have to be attentive to in the course of their activities. And it's something where people reading 100.22B, particularly after the experience of the past several months with some of the enforcement matters that you have closed out and some of the other guidance that has, well, in particular with regard to McConnell, I think that people tend to have a pretty good sense of what they think 100.22B means. I think a lawyer reviewing an ad can tell a client with some measure of certainty whether it's going to pass or flunk 100.22B.
Heartening. We'll see if we have consent.
As somebody who failed in that regard, I'm not so sure.
But in any event, we have a rule that's on the books, and we're used to reviewing it and complying with it. And if that rule changes, it is one more rule that's going to change when piled upon many, many other rules that have changed, and contribution limits that are being indexed, and coordination rules that are about perhaps to change for the third time, where it's just information that is difficult for the regulated community to process. And if you wonder how this works actually in a practical matter, let me give you a real-world example of how it would work. From time to time, the party committees send emails to supporters asking them to make contributions to them. From time to time, they send direct mail to supporters asking them to make contributions to them. And let's say, for example, there is a Democratic president in 2009. Let's say further that on November 8, 2008, they file their MPC Form 2 to be a candidate for re-election in 2012. So they're a clearly identified candidate. And let's assume further that my clients are apt to be talking to the White House Office of Political Affairs every so often, or the president's representatives at the DNC every so often, because they're attentive to their interests, and that's the sort of dialogue that occurs before candidates. So we're proposing to make a public communication that is referring to a clearly identified candidate. And under the rules as they sit now, knock wood, they don't change again in the next 12 months, we have to avoid making a coordinated communication under 109.21. So we look at the content prong. Does it republish campaign materials? No, we're not going to do that. Is it going to be an electioneering communication? Unless you do something really strange in this rulemaking, we're not going to do that. Is it going to expressly advocate a candidate's election or defeat? Well, that depends on what the definition of express advocacy means. Right now, I know how to answer that question. I look to 100.22A and B. But if you rewrite 100.22B, then my answer to that question might be different. And so the guidance that I have to give to my internet providers when they go to Joe's House of Spam to send email on a bulk mail basis, paid communications, is going to change. My advice to the direct mail house when they send the snail mail is going to have to change. And it's going to be just one more thing that's going to have to change over a period of now, you know, 7 years where seemingly everything has changed. And so that's why, you know, our plea, if you will, is if the commission facing a modular problem, however difficult to solve here and now with regard to a class of communications my clients, in fact, do not sponsor, faced with that problem, we would very much like the solution limited to that problem and not otherwise to intrude on the manner in which we otherwise do business.
Mr. Tristan.
I'm not sure I understand the concerns about changing the rules of the game and so on. First of all, in terms of 100.22B, the status of that regulation, even now as we sit here, is a bit unclear. There are two courts and two circuits that have enjoined you from enforcing it, and you've never done anything to remove those injunctions. So there's at least for those of us who are advising people in those circuits, certain uncertainty, at least, about the application of 100.22B into our clients in those jurisdictions. Secondly, we were never sure, and it's only recently, by which I mean the last, two, three, 4 years at most, that the commission has started to apply 100.22B at all. Until then, I'm remembering the Keene case and some of the other cases in which the court was, the commission was split right down the middle in a series of cases about whether 100.22B was applicable or not. So the notion that I think this is all clear and we all know what the rules are and now they're going to change on us, I think it's not, it doesn't ring true to me. What I do think has happened with respect to express advocacy is that we have commission now has a situation in which the Supreme Court, is pushing electioneering communications much more in the direction of looking like ECs under 100.22B, whether there are differences or not between express advocacy under 100.22B and the Supreme Court's test for electioneering communications, we can discuss and debate and so on, but they are clearly moving much closer together. And it seems to me that raises a variety of problems which the commission needs to resolve, like how do you report? Do you report as you may have a communication? Do you report as 48-hour reporting as IEs, or do you report as ECs and the 24-hour reporting? So there are a variety of questions that I think are now put to the commission as a result of this, and where it leads us, and of course we argue this in our comments, is that essentially, I think the only distinction that makes sense, and it is raised very clearly, that is as a statutory matter, ECs are magic words. And I think that the Justice Roberts' opinion makes that uses that, just as McConnell did, just as all the other cases that we've recent Supreme Court cases, and I think that issue has to be revisited. Whether there's, as a statutory matter, whether there's room for a 100.22B as distinct from a magic words test for IEs. We agreed with Brian in one respect, which is I think that's biting off too much for this rulemaking. I think that those issues were not really, they were touched on in the NPRM, but I think that those issues, trying to decide those issues by December 3rd, or whatever your date is going to be, strikes me as being really biting off much too much. But we urge the commission to get into those issues, because I think we're going to all face them. And I think we have this brew has been mixed up again by the court in terms of what fits where. And we do need answers to those questions. I just don't see how you can do it in this rulemaking.
Very good. Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Mr. Trister, in your comments, you said that the safe harbor is so narrowly written that it would, in most cases, simply shift the focus of inquiry back to the general rule. By that, I take it, do you think that the factors are unrepresentative of most actual issue ads?
Well, yes. That comment is based on what I said right at the beginning, which is my assumption is that if you don't fit within the safe harbor, then you go off into the general rule. The safe harbor, it seems to me, serves a very important purpose both for the commission and for the regulated community, but it won't serve that purpose if it is so detailed and so difficult to satisfy that nobody can satisfy it, or almost nobody can satisfy it. And I think if it's going to be a true safe harbor, then it needs to be clear and relatively simple. And an example would be the notion of pending, for example. We argue that pending shouldn't be in there. Now, you can find support, or at least some language, in the Roberts opinion for that. But I think as a safe harbor, if you're going to put in pending, you're just going to narrow the scope of who can rely on of the application of the safe harbor in ways that are difficult. And so I think that you have to, so we argue and urge you not to include pending as one of the elements. So we've argued to some extent each one of the prongs in our comments, trying to argue for a more a safe harbor that will truly be a useful safe harbor, a safe harbor that benefits the commission and benefits us by allowing us to apply it easily and simply. And pending is one example. Another issue that comes up, and I know Commissioner Weintraub raises specifically in her opening comments, is this issue of condemnation. And can you talk about a candidate's record in some way, voting record, positions they've taken at all? If you say no, you can't discuss them at all, well, you're not good. The safe harbor is not going to be very useful, because many, many legitimate, everybody would agree, our issue ads condemn, speak about, criticize people's votes. You've got Congress today or yesterday deciding on whether or not to vote on override the president's veto on S-CHIP. Okay, people are running ads, clearly legislative ads, saying these members of Congress, when the issue was before them 6 weeks ago, voted against S-CHIP. So you're telling them what their position is, and you're telling them you don't like it. So you're criticizing them. Are you condemning them? Well, maybe, maybe not, but you're at least criticizing them. You may even be criticizing them strongly. And that's clearly a legitimate lobbying ad. So if you say you can't talk about positions and records and prior positions, then the safe harbor, if you take them out of the safe harbor, the safe harbor just becomes a nice thing in the regulation, but your cases and our cases are not going to involve it. So we argue that that shouldn't be in there, and that you should be within the safe harbor, even if you talk about a person's record and so on. Now, there will be some cases that may make you squeamish about approving, if you allow that. But that's the nature of a safe harbor. The nature of a safe harbor is that it allows some things, because of the administrative convenience, because of the need for clear rules that allow people to operate, that you allow people to pick up something which maybe, if you reach the question of the general rule, you might conclude otherwise. But I think that's the nature of a safe harbor, and I think it's a very important way to operate. So we are, you know.
Let me ask you another question about the safe harbor language. I mean, you talked about the main number one prong, which is right now reads exclusively discusses a pending legislative or executive matter or issue. Now, we've had some commenters say, well, that in itself is too limiting because you say legislative or executive matters. An example that was given, and I forget who said it was, that, well, you need to add judicial in there because, for example, people ran ads after the Supreme Court issued its decision in the Kelo case urging federal legislation to reverse that decision. So I've also seen other people say, well, instead of saying discusses a judicial, legislative, or executive matter, it ought to just say discusses a public policy matter or issue. I mean, if you had a choice between those two or a combination of that, what do you think would be best in the safe harbor?
I think you have to pick up public issues of some kind. I think that it's not – that goes in part to my comments on pending. If you eliminate the notion of pending legislation and pending executive, then you're almost there anyway. But the fact that an issue may or may not be a pending administrative thing, you may be wanting to get candidates to take a position on some issue, and you may do it in a way which is completely non-directive. You may simply say, as an organization, C3s do this all the time, and they're covered by these rules, is to say, you know, we care about Social Security reform. Ask your candidates, you know, ask candidate X and candidate Y where they stand on that. Now, nobody can suggest that that's express advocacy, that that's the functional equivalent of express advocacy. But is it a pending legislative matter? Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. It's clearly an important economic issue in this country. And I think you have to be able to do that. Now, whether you do it within the safe harbor or you do it within the general rule, I think becomes a question for the commission in terms of how it wants to administer the statute. And we would argue for doing that, allowing that under the safe harbor, because it gives us more certainty and more ability to know in advance that we can do it.
And the problem we obviously struggled with in drafting this, and as I look through the comments, it becomes apparent, is to the degree that you expand the safe harbor, one can find oneself with it where the safe harbor is broader than the rule, and where ads are protected under the safe harbor, even though they can reasonably construed as nothing other than a call to vote for and against. And that obviously was the balance we were struggling with. Commissioner Weintraub.
Following up on what you were just saying, Mr. Chairman, I thought there was something that you said was very interesting, Michael, and that was that you seem to think that would be okay for us to write a safe harbor that could, in some circumstances, be broader than the rule itself. And that was not our view of it in drafting this. It certainly wasn't my view, and in fact, I don't think that would be an appropriate view to take of it. The safe harbor should be for the things that are safe, that are, you know, we know that this is okay. And then we can put in some examples, and that'll give people a little bit more guidance. And by the way, yesterday we asked a number of witnesses who had not done so in their written comments if they would submit supplemental comments that opine on the particular seven ads that we put in our NPRM. And I think, Brian, you're off the hook on this because I already asked Mark and you're on the same set of comments. But if you guys want to, I suspect I know what your answer would be, Mr. Morgan, but feel free. I'm not 100% sure I know where your answers would be, Michael, but I'd be interested in hearing, because we did see some diversity on that, where on the Gansky ad in particular, Mark Elias thought it wasn't even close to something that ought to be covered, and Paul Ryan sat there and looked us in the face and said, absolutely, there's no other reasonable interpretation other than an urging to vote for again. So I thought, gee, I guess one of them's not reasonable. I have to figure out which one. But I think that the safe harbor has to be narrower than the rule. And on the particular example that you brought up, I find it hard to believe that you would have one qualm, whether it's in the safe harbor or not, that, you know, reading the Roberts test And knowing that that is the general rule, the umbrella rule that we would be putting in, I just find it hard to believe that you would actually tell your client that there is some doubt about the ad that you described. Ask candidate X and candidate Y what their positions are on Social Security reform, or, you know, whatever the issue is. Would you hesitate for one second to think that, you know, we might say that was express advocacy or an electioneering communication?
No.
No. So you don't need it in the safe harbor.
I don't need that in the safe harbor, but there are issues of the kind we're talking about, like when you get into issues about condemnation and ask us to make distinctions between condemnation and strong criticism and weak criticism
You know, I'm trying to make sense of what of that footnote in the Chief Justice's opinion, which seemed to distinguish ads that condemn from ads that don't. I'm not sure that I think
too much has been made of that particular footnote. I went back. First of all, there is no Jane Doe ad. There never was a Jane Doe ad. And we all need to remember that. What there is in McConnell, it was a hypothetical. And it said, if you say vote against Jane Doe, that's express advocacy. If you instead say, if you condemn Jane Doe's record on a particular issue, then it's not. And that was it. That's the extent of the discussion in McConnell. And I think that it never gets into the key question, which is what does it mean to condemn? And it takes that as a given. Justice Roberts' footnote is responding to a point. It wasn't essentially saying, we don't have to get into that in this case. This is an as-applied challenge of an ad that doesn't condemn. It doesn't even talk about their record. So he was basically saying, we don't have to get into that in that case. I don't think you can read into that footnote a notion that either Justice Roberts or the court as a whole would say that any ad which refers to a candidate's record or position on an issue is not protected. I don't think you can find that in that footnote, and particularly given this history and what it is. So I think you're faced with having to make a decision here about how far you're going to do it. And I think that it's not, to us, when you say that can the safe harbor be broader than the basic rule, I think it's a question of how any rule that you write as a safe harbor is going to have language, it's going to have elements, it's going to have terminology, and any one of those, I think one could dream up a hypothetical that would violate the general rule or might violate the general rule. So I think it's in the nature of writing regulations, really, that you're going to come up with rules, and someone might argue, and maybe that ends up with no safe harbor. You don't have safe harbor, we just go with the general rule. But I think that the notion of safe harbors is a very valuable approach to giving certainty. And you should go as far as you feel comfortable going in that regard.
Well, I don't feel as comfortable going as far as you do, but right. I want to see if Brian has any guidance for me on Jane Doe.
Michael's point, I think, was a good one. I mean, it's not a real ad. And I think the point about the footnote is correct. It's important to note that when Chief Justice Roberts was making that point, it was a way of tacitly trying to limit the scope, or at least limit in the impression of people reading the opinion, the scope of what he wanted people to think the court was actually doing. So the question being, if that was a subject into which the court did not feel it needed to go with that opinion, is it a subject into which the commission needs to go in this rulemaking when its sole purpose for being here is to conform its regulations to the court's decision? And so it weighs further toward a careful approach by the commission, I think.
Let me ask particularly you, Michael, one question about, I hear what you're saying about, you know, pending issues versus current issues versus legislative and executive issues versus public policy issues. But if we don't say something about the issues, is it worth actually having anything in the safe harbor that says there's got to be an issue in the ad? I mean, wouldn't there always be an issue in the ad. It might be sort of a backdoor way at getting at an ad that's purely an attack on character qualifications or fitness for office. But if we've got that in there anyway, that it can't be that, and all we're going to say is, you know, there's got to be some issue in the ad, is that, does that add anything? Does that give you any more guidance?
It may be. I don't know. I haven't really. I'm trying to think of an example that wouldn't fall within the character, fitness, et cetera, prong that might still fit within a broader issue prong. And I wonder about voter guides. I'm just thinking out loud here, where you're comparing two or more candidates' positions on issues. They wouldn't fall into the other one, and I'm not sure actually. I'm not sure. The other question is about a fundraising ad, maybe that was essentially a fundraising ad that said, "Give us a lot of money," and then said something about so we can do something that suggests character. I don't know. It's I'm just not sure.
Commissioner Walthrop, had you sought recognition?
Well, just in keeping with the issue of discovery. It seems to me if we talk about pending issue, I agree, you're talking about discovery. If you're talking about condemnation, you're talking about discovery. And the idea behind a safe harbor is to make a kind of a quick and dirty analysis of where you want to go. And if you want to go beyond that, you then have to weigh the risk of, okay, is it still, it's outside the safe harbor, but we still think it's something we can do. So it seems to me if you want to have a safe harbor, like you say, it needs to be restrictive enough so that you know you're not falling outside it. And I'm on the issue thing, I'm not sure where that line could reasonably be drawn, because I'm not sure there should be a restriction on anybody saying darn near anything that they want. I mean, they can kind of pick their issue, it seems to me. It doesn't have to be a pending issue. It may be something they want to create. It must be something they've been thinking about that nobody else is thinking about and never will become an issue, but they want to say something about it. So
right. You want it to become an issue.
you want it to become an issue.
Right.
And, so, I mean, in that regard, would you have any suggestions on the ambit of what might be said in a safe harbor on the issue matter?
Well, we focused, and I think your question goes beyond that. Clearly, the pending element is too narrow, and whether you need it at all, I'm just not sure, actually. It does, I guess, in some way serve to set up a contrast between the first prong and the fourth prong. And in that sense, it may be, if you say, well, you can't do character, fitness, and such, and then somebody says, well, what can you do? You're going to say, talk about issues. So, I mean, that's what your response is going to be. And so I don't see any, I'm not troubled by it being in the prong. Whether it adds very much, I'm not sure. I'm really not sure. But it does help to...
Vice Chairman Mason.
I just wanted to remind us of why we're in this quandary. Mr. Bopp's brief to the Supreme Court proposed a standard, focuses on a current legislative branch matter. He didn't throw in the executive branch. Takes a position on the matter and urges the public to ask a legislator to take a particular position or action with respect to the matter in his or her official capacity. Does not mention any election, candidacy, political party, or challenger. And that's the issue, by the way, that brings in the question of when you're comparing two candidates for the same office, you just mentioned a challenger. Okay. You may not describe them as such, or the official's character, qualifications, or fitness for office. So there, that's what Mr. Bopp said ought to be the standard. And then in Justice Roberts, when he says, you know, this context stuff is out, except, he says, we can look at context such as whether an ad describes a legislative issue that is either currently the subject of legislative scrutiny or likely to be the subject of such scrutiny in the near future. I don't know how we figure that out, but, you know, so this is why we're in that corner. I just want to point out, we didn't make this stuff up, okay? This was not the fevered imaginings of some bureaucrats who want to clamp down on speech, okay? This is the raw material we were given by the plaintiff in the court here, and it was not of our choosing, so. I want to switch gears a little bit, Mr. Swoboda, mm-hmm. on this issue of disclosure.
Yes.
Your clients, when they are disclosing particular behind donors, you know, behind what the committees spend, use the earmarking rule. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Trister had referred to an earmarking rule in the IRS code, but in sort of the rubric of using tools we already have that people are already familiar with, why wouldn't we use our existing earmarking rule to determine when a donor has to disclose, or when a person making an electioneering communication has to disclose somebody who's donated for that purpose?
Right. There might very well be a basis for doing that if you look by analogy, for example, to the independent expenditure rules and how you treat that. And there, I mean, you do have the opinion in McConnell where they try to point out that the level of disclosure being called for by Section 201 was narrower in a way than what you were calling for in the independent expenditure disclosure. So that may weigh, you know, toward that. You know, further, I mean, as we talked about earlier, Congress did, when it first wrote Section 201, tried to give certain types of organizations the option of basically limiting their disclosure by basically limiting disclosure to the universe of people who were giving to the account from which the ad would be paid. And again, when that was first drafted, before there was a Wellstone amendment.
Yeah, I understand that, and the trouble is that sort of runs the other way, because that gives you the choice of either disclosing everybody or disclosing some people who give to a particular account. And
right.
And I was asking sort of the flip side, is we already have this earmarking rule out there. It's applied in a variety of contexts, and why wouldn't we use that to determine
right.
when the organization paying for an electioneering communication has to disclose beyond its own funds who else may have funded it.
The only reason I might see where that might be a problem is because of the separate account structure that Congress proposed as an alternative to complete organization-wide disclosure. In other words, there's a way to conclude based on the statute that Congress imagined, you know, one method by which you might limit disclosure, and that would be it. And that in a way, I guess, is broader than simply an earmarking standard. I mean, for the reason, you know, we talked about a moment ago with the Sam Wiley hypothetical, you know, the check saying this is being provided for use at your sole discretion, you know, without any indicia of earmarking, but under circumstances where, in effect, it's the sole, you know, funds, if you will, behind the ad. So that, I guess, might be the only reason why you might have difficulty doing it, and it's because the statute generally provides for that sort of broad disclosure and provides the segregated account as the envisioned way out of it, and not an earmarking rule as the way out of it.
But I guess that argument leads me to the opposite conclusion, which is to the earmarking provision would seem to be the analogous provision. So if you didn't use a segregated account, to the degree that Congress created the segregated account model, whereby you could take funds specifically designated for that and put that in the account, the earmarking, you know, adoption of the earmarking rule would achieve that identical result if you simply used your general treasury account. It also would seem to be bolstered by your argument for stability of rules, and that this is already something that people are used to using, and therefore it would be less difficult to implement. Mr. Trister?
Yeah, on the separate account, I was going to make the same point, but in addition, as a practical matter for both unions and for many 501c organizations, the money is coming out of the general treasury. They don't have the kind of money. They can't raise individual money. They have to use their general support money. And so for tax reasons, they may already set up separate segregated funds, 527, not political committees, but 527 accounts, and they transfer the money over to that for tax reasons. But they report that as a single contribution from the organization. If you allow that, then that's fine. But if you, that doesn't do much for disclosure. If you require that the money that came into the Treasury, you still have to report in the same way, then you're back to where you started. So I think that as a practical matter, these organizations have to use Treasury money. And the question is, how much or what kind of Treasury money are they going to have to report? And you heard earlier, I think the earmarking line is the line that is both in the statute for IEs and is a workable, if not perfect, line to draw in that regard.
Other questions? Questions from the council, from the staff director's side? Is that it? Okay. I wanted to, I think, end a little bit where we began, because at the very beginning of this, Mr. Morgan, in your opening statements, I think one of the first things you said was that there's a natural inclination on the part of organizations when they lose litigation to try and minimize their losses in the subsequent regulatory rulemaking process. And I think that certainly from my conversations among the commissioners individually when we've met in private to discuss this, and I think it's reflected by the conversation here, that is not a concern of ours whatsoever. Instead, what I think we're struggling with is how do we reconcile our statutory duties with the constitutional guidance from the Supreme Court in a range of different decisions over multiple decades, not all of which neatly fit together. And it's that struggle, I think, which has animated our thinking so far and will animate our final resolution of this issue. So with that, I'm going to recess our proceedings until 1 o'clock, at which point we will reconvene with our afternoon panel. Thank you very much.
Thank you.